Book Thingo podcast is a lively discussion about romance books, culture, and bad knitting. This is episode 16 featuring Tessa Dare at the Romantic Times Convention in Las Vegas. Book Thingo would like to acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which this episode was produced, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We also acknowledge the contributions of Aboriginal Australians to our shared literary heritage.
Welcome to the Book Thingo podcast, talking about books we love, especially romance. Kill a fairy fast on the Book Thingo podcast.
Welcome back to the Book Thingo podcast. I'm Kat Mayo from bookthingo.com.au, an Aussie blog for romance readers, and I am so excited to present this next episode. I'm joined by none other than the amazing Tessa Dare, who has written some of my favourite historical romances, including the Spindle Cove and the Castles Ever After series. One of the things I love about these books is that the heroines have rather unconventional interests, and we talk a little bit about that in the podcast. We also talk about fandom and the way Tessa Dare translates this phenomenon in her book Romancing the Duke. So if you like sunny heroines and brooding heroes who growl a lot and have legit issues with people in general, this book will make you swoon. You can find information on all the titles and authors we mention in this episode by going to bookthingo.com.au/podcast and clicking on episode number 16.
Oh my goodness, I think this is probably maybe about my fifth RT. I've been going almost every year since I've been published. I missed one year, I think, the Kansas City one, but I always try to come to RT because it's such a fun convention.
You publish historical romance?
Yes.
Set in which time? Because I can never get Regency versus Victorian versus Georgian.
Right, it's kind of all blurs together. I write in the Regency.
Okay, cool. And what made you decide to write in that time period?
I think it's just a matter of what I came into romance reading. I always loved historical romance. That was definitely my entry point to the genre. And I always loved Jane Austen and all of the adaptations for film and television of all of Pride and Prejudice and the other novels. And so that's really what brought me to historical romance in the first place. And I just have loved writing in it and haven't found haven't had the urge yet to leave it. So
don't leave it. One of the things that differentiates your novels from a lot of other historical romances is that you have heroines with really unusual occupations or hobbies or, I guess, personality quirks. Was that a deliberate decision?
I think I just enjoy writing about quirky women, and I think it's what I'm better at because I have my own little geeky interests, and so it seems to just come out better when I identify with the heroine. So it seems, you know, when I wrote the Spindle Cove series, like, how can I write about more nerdy women? Because I just enjoy it and it seems to click with my brain. So giving them interests in various, you know, scientific or artistic pursuits, it's just a way to give me an excuse to look up historical geology symposiums or whatever the case may be, because I geek out about those little things as well.
So how long does it normally take you to research a book?
I do most of the research as I go along. And if I know I'm writing a series that I want to set in a certain place or places, I try to take a trip and do some on-site research, just absorbing the landscape and the environs so that I can write about it more authentically. So when I was going to write the Spindle Cove series, I went to southern coast of England. East Sussex is where it's set, and visited several places along the coast there and just sort of picked and chose my favorite or most interesting parts of different towns and put it all together into one little village. And then when I was writing Castles Ever After, I took a trip and stayed in various castles and visited others. And
that's nice.
So that was really nice. Yeah, exactly.
Tax-deductible castle space.
Exactly. What a great job. So, you know, where do I go from there? You know, what can I
palaces maybe next?
I guess so. I'm going back to England this June and I'm taking my kids with me. We'll be there for most of the month. I mean, I'm going to research while I'm there for sure, but I'm not sure exactly what's coming next. So I'll just sort of wait for what inspires me, and we'll, I'm sure, be visiting various locations.
The Castles Ever After series has how many books?
It actually only has three. And then the next book that is coming out is a bit of a crossover between Castles Ever After and Spindle Cove.
Oh, okay.
So it's sort of half and half.
Is that just going to be one book, or is that going to be a
series
of
itself? That's just one book, and then I'm quite honestly not sure what I'm writing next.
That first one was Romancing the Duke.
Romancing the Duke.
Which, that's the grumpy Duke?
Yes, oh yes. God, the grumpy Duke grumpy with the Dukes. Head injury and the partial blindness, and yes.
He's... So what was that like, though? Did you have to do much research on that?
Yes, I did try to research various blindness in various respects. Obviously, my Duke was not completely blind. He was partially blinded from a head injury. So I tried to read first-person accounts of people who had lost their sight, how it changed their lives, and talk with an occupational therapist who works with people who've had traumatic injuries. And so I did work to research that, and also stayed in a castle in Northumberland, and that's where I ended up setting it and kind of had that vision in my mind. And I also used my license a little bit.
So that pairing, who came to you first, the hero or the heroine?
Well, they both changed a little bit along the way. I think the heroine definitely was the first part of it. I had her in mind first, and I was thinking about, my husband and I love to watch Game of Thrones together, and he's read all the books. I haven't read them all, but he is a fan of the book series as well. And we were talking about George R.R. Martin and whether he's ever, at that time, I wasn't sure whether he was going to get books out
before.
It did
have a bit of that feel.
Right, exactly. And it's like, what's going to happen if he, heaven forfend, were to pass away before he finishes this series? Like, it's going to leave everyone hanging. And so that's what I based that book on, was the idea that there's this man who's been writing this well-loved, long-running sort of fantasy series that takes place in medieval times. And all these people are huge fans of the characters and very invested in what's going to happen to them. And then he dies and leaves the characters in a literal cliffhanger. And Izzy, his daughter, is stuck with these fans who are adoring of her and adoring of the stories, but don't really understand that she's a woman who has her own wants and desires, and they kind of treat her as the little girl that's being told all these fairy tales for how many years. And they all want to know, of course, what was going to happen. Like, who is the real identity of this person? Kind of, you know, like, who are Jon Snow's parents? Yeah. And all that sort of thing. Right, and so she's caught, really, in this fandom for good and for bad. And so it was sort of a little way for me to sort of write a little love letter to fandom, because I love fandom, and explore that, the humor of it, a little bit more.
What I loved about that was it showed sort of the fanatic side of fandom, but Izzy always appreciated what that fandom had done for her and her father.
Right.
Even though she felt that it was stifling her.
It was both, right? She felt they support her, these, and sometimes in very concrete ways, you know. In fact, she's kind of living off the friends and admirers of her father. But at the same time, they have her hemmed into this role of the daughter, the loving daughter of this favorite. And they don't really want her to grow up. So she's had to struggle against, in between those two forces. But she always insists, what I always insist, the hero is kind of like, who are these deluded people? Have they lost touch with reality? Right. Can't you just tell them all to, you know, leave? And she is always defending them, which, you know, of course, is my own feeling, that, you know, these are, they just love these characters, and they understand the difference between fantasy and reality, but they enjoy it, and they find friendship in fandom, and they find relationships. And
I also found it to be like a metaphor for family.
Yeah.
So that was her kind of family. You could apply it to actual, you know, family who... Every family has its quirks, and when you first introduce your boyfriend or girlfriend to them, you're like, I'm not really sure how that's going to go.
That's very true. That's very true.
But I love grumpy heroes. Like,
yeah.
Grumpy heroes, I will read them, especially historical heroes.
Yeah.
And I mentioned this to you yesterday, the ending of that really reminded me a lot of the ending in Flowers from the Storm, where Gervaux had to do a competency exam.
Oh, yeah.
So that he wouldn't get put in the asylum again.
That's true, yes.
I mean, it was different circumstances, mm-hmm. but I love the way that it was handled in Romancing the Duke, where it was like a team effort to get him through it. It wasn't just him alone having to deal with what he was dealing with.
Yeah, that's what I enjoyed writing about that book. Was like the hero is saved through fandom. He has to learn to reach out to these other people because he had been this powerful man who was able to sort of just be an island unto himself. He didn't really need anyone else. And now he's had this accident. He is disabled. And it's not as though he's lost all his power, but he needs other people in a way that he didn't before.
So the second book is
Say Yes to the Marquis.
Okay.
In that book, the heroine has also inherited a castle. That's the little theme of the series. Each of the heroines has inherited a castle. Her name is Cleo. She's been engaged to a marquis for 8 years, and he has been out of the country for most of that time, working as a diplomat in various locales, and she's very tired of waiting for him. It was a family arrangement. They didn't fall in love or anything like that. And she has decided that she's going to take her castle and start a brewery at the castle and get rid of the marquis who never is coming home. Her fiancé's brother decides that he is going to make sure that she goes through with the marriage because she would have to have him sign some papers in order to formally end the engagement. And he's refusing because he doesn't want this to fall apart on his watch. He's the family screw up. He's a prize fighter, never got along with his dad. He's always the screw up of the family, the black sheep. And he's like, this one thing is not going to go wrong. You know, my brother is not going to come home to find his marriage or potential marriage fall apart. The difficulty there is that he's always had a crush on the heroine and he's always felt like, you know, but she was intended for his brother. That's been the family arrangement forever. And so he stayed away from her.
It's like a taboo love.
Yeah, I know. So like he really shouldn't go after her, but now they're in close quarters and it's really, they're talking about marriage all the time and trying to prepare her. And he's trying to give her all of these things, you know, like flowers and cakes and everything. Get her excited about the wedding, and all she's doing is falling more in love with him, and so it's I loved writing them. They were fun, I thought.
So deciding on to make your heroine a brewer,
yes,
was that something that came to you first?
Once I was writing the book, I just sort of realized, you know, I wasn't really feeling Cleo at first. And then I realized, well, she doesn't have a thing, you know. I like my heroines to have a thing, like a sort of unusual pursuit. And so I decided, well, maybe she's going to open a brewery. And then I got really into it. And I just thought, you know, and it's so improper for a lady at that time to, you know, dump her fiance and say, I'm going to make beer for a living. But actually, beer making in England until the early modern times, so in the medieval times and Shakespearean type times, it was women's work. So I really loved getting back into that, and I got to like tour a brewery and ask a lot of questions.
Taste testing?
I did. It was so bad. I emailed this man who lives near me, who is a beer blogger, and he arranged for, you know, his friends own a brewery where they brew like English ale the original way and all that sort of stuff. So I got to go there and like smell the hops and like see how they do stuff. And then I was tasting and I got like ridiculously drunk because I am a lightweight and it doesn't take very much. And so this poor man like had to like take me to get dinner. So it was a little embarrassing.
Did that scene make it to the book?
No, I didn't let her get too drunk. But they do have a scene where they have, you know, a midnight snack of cake and beer for various reasons. And so
it's kind of interesting. I'm somewhat obsessed with the Hamilton soundtrack.
Oh, and somewhat. Yes, I think we all are.
And one of the themes in that musical is who gets to tell the story of history.
Yeah.
And how certain people or certain classes of people are erased.
Yes.
Because they're not the storytellers.
Absolutely.
So when you include unusual pursuits by women in historical romance, I always feel like, is this an untold story that authors are bringing out, even if it's, you know, fictionalized with artistic license,
mm-hmm.
that at some point their research has told them that women actually did work like this?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you said that because I feel exactly the same way. I feel like historical romance and writing women who did these interesting things, it's a way to write some women back in to history because women were doing interesting things. So this was wartime during the Regency and a lot of the men were gone. And so we know what happens in wartime from our own sort of even just last century within America. The men all went to war during World War II and the women were the ones who went to the factory. We had Rosie the Riveter and, you know, women took over their family business, the family farm. And I'm sure that the same thing was happening in England at this time. Women were running the businesses. They were running the farms. They were taking on roles that they didn't have. And I'm absolutely certain that there were women who are doing all of these things that we just don't know about. And even, you know, sometimes scholarship has unearthed more information about these women. Like, for example, Mary Anning was one of the first women who discovered the dinosaur fossils. She lived in Lyme Regis and she would basically rappel on these scaffolding things down the cliffs and like hammer out these fossils, these big chalk cliffs, right? And come and find all these bones and teeth and all these interesting fossils. And then she would sell them to the wealthy gentlemen in England who would come present them at the Royal Geological Society, which did not admit women. So she was doing all of the work and all of the discovery.
Credit was going to the men?
And the credit was going to the men. And so now we know a little bit more about her, but she, you know, they never mentioned her. They were just like, ha ha, look at this bone I found, you know? And she wasn't getting any of it, you know? So I definitely believe that there were lots of women doing interesting things.
I love that some of this history is being explored in a genre that gets looked down upon. And then you can turn around and say, look, we're telling stories that aren't commonly told about mm-hmm. women in history. Even though it's fiction, mm-hmm. you know, these are all based on historical sources. Mm-hmm. And they did happen.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So book three of Castles Ever After.
Book three of Castles Ever After is When a Scot Ties the Knot. And that, nice. Oh my gosh, that was so much fun because I wrote the heroine as this very shy woman who does not want, well, she starts as a girl. She's a very shy teenage girl. She does not want anything to do with the London season, getting married. She's being pressured to marry because her father has remarried and the young wife is like, okay, hey, time to get out of the house and leave us alone.
Oh, and the stepmother is she's sweet and well-meaning, but just completely like on the wrong track.
Yeah, she's not a bad person, but she's, you know, but she's a that. Young wife. She
I love that.
Wants to have her home to herself with her husband, and that's not a horrible thing. But
I love that the conflict is a real conflict, but it comes from a place of meaning well rather than a purely selfish reason. Because, you know, stepmothers are quite often vilified in not just romance, but in many stories.
In lots of stories.
But I love that you found a way to make her sort of the antagonist without making her like an evil person.
It's just,
you can see if you were the new wife, maybe that's what you'd want to do.
Sure, of course. I'd want the teenage girl out of the house too. And I think I always do best that way as a writer when I can write the characters as well-meaning people with cross purposes because I'm just not good at writing evil people. It just doesn't, or even if I do it, like the readers never seem, they're like, but that person was so mean.
Yeah.
And I think, well, yeah, they were supposed to be mean, but I don't know, people don't seem to want it from me. So I've just, you know, I try not to write villains. I'm just not good at it. So yes, Maddie, instead of she's so panicked at the idea of being forced to go to balls and find a husband, she comes up with this lie that she met this Scottish captain in the army and fell in love with him and agreed to marry him. And then he immediately shipped off with his regiment to fight in the Napoleonic
Wars. I love the way
this
is set up.
Right.
So
and
much.
So in the US, I don't know how it works in Australia, but we have this joke about the Canadian boyfriend or girlfriend, right? Like where if you want to pretend when you're a teenager that you have a boyfriend or girlfriend, then you're like, oh, but they live in Canada, so you don't know them. That's like a recurring joke. You know, I have this girlfriend. friend who lives in Canada, and she's a model, but, you know, you wouldn't have heard of her. Right. So so this is my Canadian boyfriend, his Scottish boyfriend. And so, you know, she tells him, and his family's all dead, so you can't meet them either, but I'm going to write him letters, and he really loves me, and we're going to get married when he comes back. And so she keeps up this lie for years and years and years, and she writes all these letters where she's just kind of like writing a journal, essentially, and just sending them to an address just that doesn't exist.
She's doing like an emotional dump in these letters.
Yes,
right. It's like
right.
a dear diary.
Exactly. And then... Everything she can't say, she's like putting in these letters, her frustrations about her family and all these, her changing feelings. She's growing up, basically, and she's sending all these things out into what she believes is a void. And then eventually she kills him off because she gets tired of keeping up the lie and she feels too guilty. And so she tells...
And is it that she felt like she was old enough now not to be pressured?
I think so. Okay. You know, and she'd inherited this castle. She had a place of her own to live. And she just didn't want to lie to people anymore. So she kills him off. And still doesn't have to marry anyone because she has a house of her own, a castle of her own.
And the castle becomes important.
Yeah. So then what she doesn't know is there is an actual Captain Logan Mackenzie, this name that she made up out of nowhere.
I felt like if she was going to make up a name, she should have made up a less common name.
I know, right? She wasn't thinking. And he's been getting all these letters all these years, including the one where she killed him off. And at first he thought it was just weird, like, where is this girl? This, and, you know, sort of laughed at her. And then, but her letters came to mean something to him because he doesn't have any family and he was an orphan, and it became to be really important to him. And he was really pissed off that she killed him off and just cut off this. So he comes back from the war with his few of his band of soldiers in tow, the guys who also have nothing left to come home to, and decides, you know what, I'm going to look up this girl, call her on her bluff, and she's either going to have to tell everybody that she lied, or she's going to marry me, and I'll get to live in this castle and have a home for these guys who depend on me.
I love that, by the way, that suddenly we have this hero who now has to make a home for his sort of adopted family.
Yes.
Whereas we normally have that as the heroine's, I guess, job in romance.
Yeah.
She's the family maker, and then it's the hero who's like, I'm going to be alone, blah, blah.
Yeah,
and it's kind of
true.
Reversed, right?
I don't really think about that. Yeah, but yeah, Logan's very loyal, and he didn't have a family of his own, so these guys are like his family.
And some of them are suffering from PTSD, as you did from the war. So.
Yes, they have various problems, you know. Grant, oh, poor Grant. Everybody wants a romance for Grant. I'm like, oh, I don't know how that would work.
Novella,
he's got a short-term
maybe.
Memory problem, right? Anyway, Maddie and Logan, she's stunned when this guy shows up and he's actually kind of hot, and she doesn't want to own up to the fact that she lied all these years. And so she's like, fine, I guess we'll get married and you guys can just live here and you'll let me do my thing and I'll let you do yours and we don't have to actually like...
It's like a marriage of convenience.
A marriage of convenience, right? And then we could put everything to bed and then it's almost like I haven't lied all this time, right? And so they do, you know, get married, and of course... The plan to just, exactly, the plan, then, you know, she comes upon him reading in bed with his glasses on, and it's all over from there, you know, it's too sexy to stop, so, yes, various things happen from there.
And then the novel that crosses over between Castles Ever After and Spindle Cove?
That's the one that's coming out in late September. It's called Do You Want to Start a Scandal? And so that
Yes, please.
Why not? That has Piers, who is the Marquis that got said no to.
Oh, excellent.
Yes, because he's actually, even though he was gone for 8 years, had a good reason, right, unbeknownst to Cleo and everyone else. He's working as an agent for the crown, and he's supposedly a diplomat, but also doing these underhand things on behalf of the government, and he was afraid to marry her because he didn't want to endanger her if ever he was found out. And so...
Oh, I love that.
Yeah,
so it was for noble reasons.
It was for noble reasons, is right? And of course, it all worked out for the best because his brother married her and they're really in love. But he is still working for the crown and he has no interest in marrying for love because, again, you know, he's worried about the danger aspect, and also he's just... He's worried it would compromise his judgment and his ability to do his job. He's at a house party for reasons, and Charlotte, the younger sister of Minerva and Diana from the Spindle Cove series, is there as well. She's grown up a bit. And they are accidentally caught, but not it wasn't them. Somebody had sex in the library.
Okay.
And it's assumed, because they're found together in the same room after, that it was Piers and Charlotte. But it wasn't.
It's like Cluedo.
Exactly.
Like sexy time.
Yes. Yes. It is Clue in the Regency. But this young kid has overheard all these. What happens is they go in, they're talking in this room, and then other people come in and they hide. And these other people have this loud, noisy sex, and like while they're hiding behind a curtain, mortified. And they finally come out and they're like, that was awkward. And this little kid comes in, he's like, I heard these noises, murder noises. And he like recreates them in front of everybody, like, and they come in and there we're there. He's trying to murder her or something. And so it's like they have the appearance of having had this really embarrassing tryst. And Piers is like, well, he's, noble. And he's like, well, I'll marry her. And, I need a wife anyway. I don't want to fall in love. She'll do. She's pretty. And, she can give me babies that I need. And it'll work. It'll solve several problems. And she's like, no, of course, if you know Charlotte at all. I don't want to marry this older guy who is not interested in love. I'm young and I want to meet somebody and fall in love with them and have a normal life, and not be tied to this man forever. Her plan is to find the true lovers.
Right.
And force them to confess or unmask them in some way so that then her own reputation will be cleared and she doesn't have to marry Piers. So while she's, skulking about and looking for clues, Piers happens to be along a lot of the time and she discovers that, he's not this sort of buttoned up guy that he seems to be, like, knows how to pick locks and he can disarm this guy in like three blows and he's
more interesting than he first.
Yeah, and he's kind of sexy. Yeah. And he might be the most interesting mystery in this house. And he of course starts to have inconvenient feelings for her and discovers that she's a lot more clever than he supposed. Yeah.
So that's in September.
That is.
So I cannot wait for that book.
Oh, good.
Then you said you don't know what you're going
to
be writing.
I honestly don't. I have some different ideas, and I have to talk to the editor. And
are they going to be historicals, do you think, still?
Oh, yes. All my ideas are still historical. But I'm just not, I'm not sure if we'll start a new series or if we'll do, maybe some more like sort of one-offs with secondary. I don't know.
Okay.
I got to see what she thinks and what I think.
I'm sure it's going to be excellent no matter what it is. Because I have not had any Tessa Dare books that I didn't like.
Oh, well, I'm so glad. I everyone is hard. I sweat over each one. And I'm always convinced when I turn it in that it's like the worst thing ever written. And
it's amazing. Authors always say that. But when as a reader, when I read a book, I'm like, oh, it's so
like
great.
Desperation and Starbucks. It's like, that's all it is. But, I love the fact that it looks that way to you. I kind of liken it to knitting, like bad knitting. I do bad knitting. I wrote that into a book where, you make a scarf for somebody and like when you give it to them, like all you see are like the missed stitches and the parts where you screwed up. I try to tell myself it's the same way. People just want to feel warm and cuddly and they're not going to care that much if there's little missing stitches or
this doesn't link up to that. Because they're so excited and they just want to know what happens.
Right. And when are they going to finally have sex? Let's be honest, that's important as well.
Do you find the sex scenes harder or easier to write than the rest of the book?
When I was starting out, it was a little tricky at first. I always say it's like real sex. Should I be doing this? What will my parents say? And then you get used to it and it's fun. It's like you want to do it in every position. And then after a while, the problem is, okay, how can I not do the same sex scene I've done three times already? And it's like, you feel like, well, if I find a place that I haven't used yet, is it just going to be outlandish and crazy? And how can you make it unique? And so I'm sort of in that place now where I still love writing the love scenes, but I'm always like trying to, okay, how can
There's
I make
pressure
this
to
different?
Make it stand out from
yeah without like putting them
now I'm thinking of Sex in the Library and thinking I hope they didn't damage any books while they were doing that.
Sex Thank in the library is always sexy.
That's all we have time for in this episode. Once again, massive thanks and long-stemmed roses to our amazing audio producer Rudy Bremer. You can find the show notes at bookthingo.com.au/podcast. Just click on episode 16. If you have any feedback or suggestions, you can send me a tweet at BookThingo or send an email to podcast@bookthingo.com.au. We received some great comments for our previous episode featuring Wendy the Super Librarian. Chrissy J tweeted that it was an excellent interview, and Vaveros tweeted that it was a great podcast that hit all the high points on libraries, romance, and readers. Aztec Lady left a comment on the blog to say, "Thank you, thank you, thank you. I could listen to you two talk about romance and libraries for a few more hours at a run." Well, no doubt we would have if we hadn't been kicked out of the room we were in. So thank you to everyone who commented, tweeted, retweeted, and liked the podcast. It really means so much to us here at BookThingo. As always, you can find me, Rudy, and the other BookThingo bloggers at bookthingo.com.au. This weekend, I'll be in Adelaide for the Romance Writers of Australia Conference, and I'll be doing some quick interviews with authors. So if you're keen to be a guest on the podcast, please send me an email. In the next episode, we'll be featuring the amazing Alyssa Cole. We talk about diversity in romance and cultural Easter eggs, and we discuss some of Alyssa's findings in her research on romance author communities around the world. It's a really fascinating discussion about the interplay between culture and romance writing that I think you guys will enjoy. Until then, I hope you have a fabulous fortnight of reading.